Antiquities, Book 15. How, when the city of Jerusalem had been taken by Sosius and Herod, Antony beheaded Antigonus at Antioch, and Herod put to death 45 of the leading men among Antigonus's partisans in Jerusalem and extorted money from the city. How Hyrcanus, first king of the Jews and high priest, was released by Arsaces, king of the Parthians, and returned to Herod. How Herod, having appointed Aristobulus, his wife Mariam's brother, high priest, arranged not long after to have him destroyed. How Cleopatra, scheming against the kingdoms of the Jews and the Arabs, managed to obtain portions of them from Antony. Cleopatra's visit to Judea. How Herod made war on Aretas at the time when Antony was defeated by Caesar in the battle at Actium. Concerning the earthquake that occurred in Judea and the destruction of men and livestock. Herod's speech to the Jews, who were disheartened by their sufferings and the defeat they had suffered. How Herod, being obliged to go to Caesar after his victory, put Hyrcanus to death. How he received the kingdom from Caesar as well, and escorted him as far as Egypt. How Herod, on arriving at Alexandria, was honored by Caesar. How, on his return, he was provoked by false accusations to kill his wife Mariam. Concerning the famine that occurred in Judea and Syria, and how Herod saved the populace and the cities. The Greek cities Herod founded. How he tore down the ancient temple in Jerusalem, and 600 years later, raised another in its place, double the former in its dimensions. This book covers a period of 18 years. Sosius and Herod then, having by force taken Jerusalem and captured Antigonus besides, this the previous book has already told us. What follows on from it we shall now relate. When Herod had been entrusted with rule over the whole of Judea, as for the populace in the city, all those private citizens who still favored Antigonus's cause he advanced and promoted, while those who had chosen the side of his opponents, he never ceased punishing and chastising day by day. Above all others, he honored Pollian the Pharisee and Sammias, his disciple. For while Jerusalem was under siege, these two had advised the citizens to receive Herod, and for this they now received their reward. This same Pollian, at the time Herod was once on trial for his life, had foretold, rebuking Hyrcanus and the judges, that Herod, once he escaped, would take vengeance on all of them. And in time this came to pass, God bringing his words to fulfillment. At that time, once he had gained control of Jerusalem, Herod gathered up every ornament in the kingdom, stripping the wealthy of their property besides, and having amassed a great quantity of silver and gold, he gave it all as gifts to Antony and the friends around him. He put to death the 45 leading men of Antigonus's faction, stationing guards at the gates of the walls so that nothing might be smuggled out along with the dead, and had the corpses searched. Whatever silver or gold or any treasure was found on them was brought up to the king. There was no end to the hardships. On one hand, the greed of a ruler who found himself in need consumed everything, while on the other, the sabbatical year was forcing the land to lie unworked. For that year had then arrived, and sowing the land during it is forbidden to us. Antony, having taken Antigonus prisoner, at first decided to keep him in chains until his triumph. But when he heard that the nation was in revolt and remained loyal to Antigonus out of its hatred for Herod, he decided to behead him at Antioch, for the Jews were scarcely able to keep still at all. My account is confirmed by Strabo of Cappadocia, who writes as follows. Antony beheaded Antigonus the Jew, after he had been brought to Antioch. And he was thought to be the first Roman to behead a king, since he supposed there was no other way to change the disposition of the Jews so that they would accept Herod, set up in his place. For not even under torture would they consent to acclaim him king, so exalted was their regard for their former king. He therefore reckoned that the disgrace would diminish the memory of Antigonus, and would also diminish the hatred felt toward Herod. So much for Strabo. Now when Hyrcanus the high priest, who was a prisoner among the Parthians, learned that Herod had gained control of the kingdom, he came to Herod, having been released from his captivity in the following manner. Barzapharnes and Pacorus, the Parthian generals, had taken captive Hyrcanus, who had first become high priest and then king, along with Herod's brother Phasael, and were leading them off to Parthia. Phasael, unable to bear the disgrace of his chains, and judging a death with honor preferable to any life, became his own murderer, as I have already related. But when Hyrcanus was brought before him, Phraates, king of the Parthians, treated him more leniently, having learned beforehand of the distinction of his noble birth. For this reason, he released him from his chains and allowed him to take up residence in Babylon, where a large community of Jews also lived. These honored Hyrcanus as high priest and king, as did the whole Jewish nation settled as far as the Euphrates, and this was gratifying to him. But when he learned that Herod had taken possession of the kingdom, his hopes shifted course. He had from the start been affectionately disposed toward Herod, and expected that Herod would remember the favor he owed him, since he, Hyrcanus, had, when Herod was on trial and about to be punished with death, rescued him from the danger and the penalty. He therefore made overtures, being eager that the Jews there let him go to Herod. But they clung to him and urged him to stay, citing both the services and the honors due him, saying that nothing was lacking in the honor they showed him, such as is due to high priests or kings, and more importantly, that there, in Judea, he could not even share in these honors on account of the mutilation of his body, which he had suffered at the hands of Antigonus, and that kings do not repay favors in the same way once received, as they did when they were still private citizens. Fortune not unreasonably changing men's character. Though they urged such considerations, appealing to his own advantage, Hyrcanus longed to leave, and Herod, writing to him, urged him to entreat Phraates and the Jews there not to begrudge him, since he would share the kingdom with him with all his power. For now, he said, was the time for him to repay the favors for which he was indebted, having been raised and preserved by Hyrcanus, and for Hyrcanus to receive them in turn. Writing this to Hyrcanus, he also sent to Phraates an envoy, Saramalla, along with many gifts, asking him, out of the same generosity, not to hinder the favors owed to his own benefactor. But his zeal did not spring from this motive. Rather, because he feared that his own rule was not held by right, reversals brought about for good reasons, he was anxious to have Hyrcanus in his own hands, or else to remove him altogether. And this, indeed, he did later. At that time, however, once Hyrcanus had arrived, persuaded to come, with the Parthians' consent, and after the Jews there had contributed money for the journey, Herod received him with every honor, gave him the first place in assemblies, and, seating him ahead of himself at banquets, deceived him by calling him father, and by every means contriving that his plot go unsuspected. He also arranged other matters to suit the interests of his rule, and from these arose the strife within his own household as well. For, wary of appointing any man of distinction as high priest of God, he sent for a priest of no great standing from Babylon, named Aninol, and gave him the high priesthood. Alexandra could not bear this insult at once, she being the daughter of Hyrcanus and wife of Alexander, son of King Aristobulus, and had by Alexander two children. A son, Aristobulus, of striking beauty, and a daughter, Mariam, married to Herod, remarkable for her loveliness. She was troubled and took hard the dishonor done her son, that while he was still living some outsider should be judged worthy of the high priesthood, and she wrote to Cleopatra, a certain musician assisting her in arranging the delivery of the letter, asking Antony to obtain the high priesthood for her son. When Antony responded rather half-heartedly, his friend Delius, who had come to Judea on some business, saw Aristobulus and was struck with admiration at his youthful bloom, marveling at the boy's stature and beauty, and no less at Mariam, the king's wife. And he made it clear he considered Alexandra the mother of remarkably beautiful children. When she entered into conversation with him, he persuaded her to have portraits of both painted and sent to Antony, since, once he had seen them, he would refuse her nothing she asked. Elated by these words, Alexandra sent the portraits to Antony. And Delius embellished the matter, declaring that in his opinion these children seemed born not of mortals, but of some god, all the while scheming on his own account to draw Antony toward pleasure. Antony, however, was ashamed to send for the girl, married as she was to Herod, and, guarding against the accusations such a summons would provoke from Cleopatra, wrote instead asking that the boy be sent with due honor, adding, if it did not seem burdensome. When this message was brought to Herod, he judged it unsafe to send Aristobulus, who was of striking beauty. He happened to be 16 years old, and of eminent birth, to Antony, who held more power than any other Roman at that time, and who was ready to submit him to his own passions, procuring his pleasures openly by virtue of his power. He therefore wrote back that, Should the young man once leave the country, everything would be filled with war and turmoil, the Jews hoping for a change of regime and a revolt in favor of another king. Having thus put Antony off with these excuses, he decided not to keep dishonoring the boy and Alexandra any longer. And, since his wife Mariam was also urgently pressing him, to give the high priesthood back to her brother, judging it moreover to his own advantage, since once honored with the office the young man could not travel abroad. He convened an assembly of his friends and accused Alexandra at length, claiming she had secretly plotted against the kingdom and was working through Cleopatra to have him stripped of his rule so that the young man might take over affairs in his place through Antony. And in wanting this, he said, she acted unjustly, since in doing so she would also be depriving her own daughter of the honor she held, and would be stirring up turmoil over a kingdom he himself had won through great toil and no ordinary dangers. Yet he would not, he said, let his memory of her misconduct turn him from dealing justly with them. Rather, even now he was giving the boy the high priesthood, and explaining that he had appointed Aninal earlier only because Aristobulus was then still an infant. He said all this deliberately, calculating precisely, exactly what he intended, so as to deceive the women and the friends present with him. And Alexandra, overcome at once by joy at this unexpected turn, and by fear born of suspicion, defended herself with tears, saying that regarding the priesthood she had pursued every possible course only out of the dishonor she felt. But as for the kingdom, she neither had designs upon it, nor would wish to take it even were it offered to her. And that now she had honor enough through his rule, and security enough, since his ability to rule more effectively than others benefited the whole family. Now, overcome by his kindnesses, she said she would accept the honor for her son and would be obedient in every respect, and she begged pardon in advance for anything she might have done rashly out of resentment at ill treatment, prompted by her rank and the freedom of speech it allowed her. Having spoken to one another in this way, they parted more solemnly than swiftly, clasping hands, with, as they supposed, all suspicion now removed. King Herod at once took the high priesthood away from Aninal, who was, as we said before, not a native, but one of the Jews settled beyond the Euphrates, for no small number of this people had settled in Babylonia. From there Aninal came, of high priestly stock, and had long been on close terms with Herod. Herod himself had honored him when he took the kingdom, and now dismissed him himself in order to quell the strife within his household, thereby acting against the law. For no one else had ever been deprived of the office once he had received it. Rather, the first to violate the law was Antiochus Epiphanes, who removed Jesus from office and installed his brother Onias in his place. The second was Aristobulus, who removed his brother Hyrcanus, and Herod was the third, who transferred the office to the young Aristobulus in his turn. For the moment, then, it seemed he had healed the troubles within his household. Yet, as one might expect, the reconciliation did not proceed free of suspicion, for he feared Alexandra, both on account of what she had already attempted and lest, should she find the occasion, she might again venture some revolutionary undertaking. He therefore ordered her to remain confined to the palace and to do nothing on her own authority, and careful watch was kept over her, so that nothing she did, even in the course of her daily routine, escaped notice. All this gradually provoked her and bred hatred in her, for, being full of a woman's proud spirit, she chafed under this surveillance born of suspicion, and thought herself deserving of anything rather than living out her life deprived of her freedom of speech, under the mere trappings of honor while in servitude and fear. She therefore sent repeated letters to Cleopatra, lamenting her situation and appealing to her to help as far as she was able. Cleopatra told her to escape secretly to her in Egypt, taking her son with her. This plan was adopted, and she contrived the following scheme. She had two coffins prepared, as though for the removal of corpses, and placed herself and her son inside them, ordering the servants who were in on the secret to carry them out by night. From there, a road led to the sea, where a ship stood ready to carry them across to Egypt. Aesop, a servant of hers, blurted this out to Sabio, one of her friends, thinking he already knew and could be told. But Sabio, who had formerly been an enemy of Herod's, being reckoned one of those who had conspired against Antipater in the poisoning affair, expected to exchange his enmity for goodwill by informing on her, and reported Alexandra's plot to the king. Herod let the attempt proceed as far as the actual undertaking and caught her in the very act of the escape, but let the offense pass. Not that it would have been at all difficult for him, however much he might have wished it, to deal harshly with her. But he did not dare, since he knew Cleopatra would not tolerate being given cause for her hatred against himself. Instead, he made a display of magnanimity, forgiving them out of consideration. He was, however, fully resolved to remove the young man from his path altogether. But he judged it more plausible, for the sake of concealment, not to act quickly or immediately after these events. And when the Feast of Tabernacles fell due, a festival observed among us with the utmost strictness, he let those days go by and gave himself over to festivity, he and the rest of the people along with him. Yet even amid these very festivities, something occurred that stirred him and openly spurred on his resolve, envy. For the young Aristobulus, now 17 years old, when he went up to the altar according to the law to perform the sacrifices, wearing the vestments of the high priests and carrying out the rites of worship, he was the handsomest of men and taller than his years would suggest, and in his very features he showed plainly the nobility of his lineage. A surge of goodwill toward him ran through the crowd, and the vivid memory of what his grandfather Aristobulus had accomplished rose before them. Little by little they were overcome and betrayed their feelings, rejoicing and weeping together, and sending up toward him cries of blessing mixed with prayers, so that the people's goodwill became plain to see, and their open acknowledgement of what they had suffered seemed too bold to make under a king's eye. After all this, Herod resolved to carry through the design he had formed against the youth. When the festival had ended, he was entertained at Jericho, Alexandra receiving them there, and showing the young man every kindness and drawing him on to unguarded drinking, he was ready to join in his games and to play the youth's part in whatever pleased him. Since the climate of that place ran rather hot, the company, gathered together, soon went out in high spirits and stood by the pools, which were large, around the courtyard, to cool themselves in the fiercest heat of noon. At first they watched the servants and friends swimming. Then, when the young man too was drawn in, for that too Herod had contrived, the friends to whom the task had been assigned, as darkness came down, kept pressing him and holding him under, as if in sport while he swam, and did not let go until they had drowned him utterly. So Aristobulus perished, not having lived out 18 years, having held the high priesthood 1 year, which Aninal now recovered again. When the disaster was reported to the women, at once, with the sudden change, mourning arose over the body laid out before them, and grief beyond bearing. And the city, when the news spread, was in anguish throughout, every household making the calamity its own, as though it had happened to no stranger. Alexandra was seized with grief even more, because she understood the full truth of the loss. The pain of knowing how it had been done pressed on her all the more, yet she forced herself to endure it, looking ahead to a still greater evil. Many times, she came close to taking her own life with her own hand, but she held back, asking herself whether by living she might yet be of use to the one destroyed by so lawless a plot. And she reckoned that giving no hint of her suspicion that her son had been deliberately murdered would serve her better when the time came for revenge. So she bore her suspicion with self-command. Herod, for his part, worked to persuade everyone around him, plausibly enough, that the boy's death had not come about by design, not only observing every outward form of mourning, but shedding tears, and displaying a genuine turmoil of soul. Perhaps because the horror of what he had done overcame him at the sight of the boy's youth and beauty, even though he had judged the boy's death necessary for his own safety, but clearly also because he was working to construct his own defense. As for the expense of the funeral, he made an even greater display of it, providing lavishly for the bier and for the quantity of spices, and burying with him a great store of ornaments, so as to stun the women out of their grief and console them by this means. None of it, however, moved Alexandra. The memory of the wrong, ever more present to her, only sharpened her pain into open lament and a hunger for vengeance, and she wrote to Cleopatra of Herod's plot and of the boy's destruction. Cleopatra, who had long been eager to help her at her request and pitied Alexandra's misfortunes, took the whole matter as her own and kept urging Antony not to let the murder of the boy go unpunished. For it was not fitting, she said, that Herod, who owed his kingship to Antony and had no rightful claim to it among the truly royal houses, should get away with such lawless acts against them. Persuaded by these arguments, Antony, who happened then to be at Laodicea, sent orders that Herod should come to clear himself of the charges concerning Aristobulus, since the plot, if indeed it had been his doing, had not been rightly carried out. Herod, fearing both the accusation and Cleopatra's hostility, she never let up in working to turn Antony against him, resolved to obey, since there was nothing else he could do. But he left his uncle Joseph as guardian of the government and of affairs there, and gave him a secret order that if anything should happen to him at Antony's hands, Mariam should at once be put to death. For he himself, he said, loved his wife with deep affection, and he dreaded the outrage of her being courted by someone else for her beauty once he was dead. And in fact, everything pointed to Antony's own desire for the woman, since he had long since heard reports of her beauty. So Herod, having given these instructions, and holding no secure hope for the outcome of the whole affair, set out for Antony. Joseph, meanwhile, in charge of the administration of the kingdom's affairs, and for that reason in constant contact with Mariam, kept up frequent conversations with her about Herod's business, and, out of the respect due to her as queen, spoke often of his devotion and affection for her. When the women, Alexandra above all, mocked these words in their womanish way, Joseph, overeager to demonstrate the king's true state of mind, was carried so far as to reveal the order he had been given, offering it as proof that Herod could not live without her, and even should some terrible thing befall him, could not bear to be parted from her even by death. So much for Joseph. The women, as one might expect, took from this not the devotion in Herod's feelings toward Mariam, but the harshness of it, that not even in dying would he spare her the same ruin and violent death. And, seizing on this, they were filled with a grim foreboding at what had been said. Meanwhile, a rumor arose in the city of Jerusalem, put about by those who hated Herod, that Antony had tortured and killed him. The report threw everyone around the palace into alarm, as one would expect, and the women most of all. Alexandra persuaded Joseph to go out with them from the palace and take refuge with the standards of the Roman legion, which was then encamped near the city to guard the kingdom, under the command of the son of Judas. For by this, first, if any disturbance should arise about the court, they would be safer having the Romans well disposed toward them, and further, she hoped that if Antony should set eyes on Mariam, he would grant everything, and that through this, she would recover the kingdom and lack nothing that was due to those of royal birth. While they were caught up in these calculations, a letter arrived from Herod concerning the whole affair, contradicting the rumor and everything that had been said before. For when he had come before Antony, he quickly won him over with the gifts he had brought from Jerusalem, and quickly, through their conversations, brought him to a friendlier disposition toward him, and Cleopatra's arguments carried less weight in turning Antony against him. For Antony said it was not right for a king to be called to account for what he had done within his own realm. That would make him no king at all, but that, having granted him the honor and judged him worthy of the power, one should let him use it as he saw fit. The same held, he said, for Cleopatra's own interest, that the affairs of rulers not be pried into. On these matters Herod wrote, and went on to list the other honors he enjoyed with Antony, sharing his seat at hearings and dining with him every day, and how, though Cleopatra's slanders against him were bitter on this account, he came through them unscathed. For out of desire for his country, she had been pressing to have his kingdom added to her own, and was working by every means to have him removed. Still, finding Antony just, he expected no further trouble, but rather that Antony's goodwill toward him and his kingdom and its affairs would now be firmer than before, since Antony, in place of what Cleopatra had asked for, had given her seal Syria instead, and by this had both placated her and put an end to the pleas she kept making regarding Judea. When this letter arrived, they gave up the impulse that had seized them, to flee to the Romans as though all were lost. Yet their intention did not go unnoticed. When the king, having escorted Antony as far as against the Parthians, returned to Judea, at once his sister Salome and his mother reported to him the plan Alexandra's party had formed, and Salome went further, bringing a charge against her own husband Joseph, making it out as slander that he had continued in intimacy with Maryam. She said this out of a long-standing resentment toward Maryam, because in their quarrels, Maryam, carrying herself with too much pride, would throw their low birth in their faces. Herod, who was always passionately and jealously devoted to Maryam, was at once thrown into turmoil and could not bear the jealousy. Yet, holding himself back from doing anything rash out of his love, driven hard by passion and jealousy together, he questioned Maryam privately about her dealings with Joseph. She swore her innocence and set out, in her own defense, everything that could be said for one who had done no wrong. And little by little the king was won over and, overcome by his tenderness for her, moved past his anger, so that he began to apologize for having believed what he had heard, and to acknowledge with much gratitude her chastity. He confessed, for his part, how deep his affection and devotion to her ran, and at last, as happens in matters of love, they fell to tears, clinging to each other with great feeling. But as the king, more and more, kept affirming his devotion, insisting that it was not mere fondness, Maryam spoke of the order he had given, that if he should suffer some harm at Antony's hands, she too, guilty of nothing, should perish with him. At this word, once it had slipped out, the king was overcome with anguish. At once he let her go from his arms, cried aloud, and tore at his own hair, saying that here was plain proof that Joseph had shared intimacy with her, for she would never have revealed what he had told her in private unless great trust had grown up between them. In this state he came close to killing his wife, but mastered still by his love for her, he checked that impulse, though the struggle cost him bitter and painful effort. Joseph, however, he ordered killed without even being brought before him, and Alexandra, as responsible for it all, he had bound and kept under guard. Meanwhile, trouble had also arisen concerning Syria, since Cleopatra would not let Antony rest from seizing everything. For she kept urging him to strip each ruler of his domain and give it to her, and she had great power over him through his desire for her. By nature delighting in greed, she left no wrongdoing undone. She had already had her own brother poisoned, foreseeing that the kingdom would fall to him when he was but 15 years old, and had her sister Arsinoe killed at Ephesus, where she had taken refuge as a suppliant at the temple of Artemis through Antony's agency. For the sake of money, wherever she thought there was any hope of it, she spared neither temples nor tombs from plunder, no shrine being thought so inviolable that its treasures were not stripped from it, nor anything profane so forbidden that it was not touched, if only it promised to enrich her wrongful greed. In short, nothing was ever enough for a woman so extravagant and so enslaved to her desires, unless everything she set her mind on fell short of nothing she craved. For this reason, she kept pressing Antony always to strip something more from others and grant it to her, and, crossing Syria together with him, she planned to make it her own possession. Lysanias, son of Ptolemy, she had put to death, charging him with bringing in the Parthians against the state's interests, and she asked Antony for Judea and the land of the Arabs, demanding that their kings be stripped of their thrones. Antony, as it happened, was altogether mastered by the woman, so that he seemed to obey her wishes not merely through their intimacy, but as though under the power of drugs. Yet the sheer visibility of the injustice held him back from going so far, in his complete submission to her, as to commit the very worst wrongs. So, in order neither to refuse her outright nor to appear openly wicked by doing everything she demanded, he took portions of territory from each ruler and made her a gift of these instead. He also gave her the cities within the Eleutherus River as far as Egypt, apart from Tyre and Sidon, which he knew from their ancestors to be free cities, though she pressed hard to have these two given to her. Having obtained these, Cleopatra escorted Antony as far as the Euphrates on his campaign against Armenia, then turned back and came to Apamea and Damascus, and passed also into Judea, where Herod met her and leased from her both the portions given her in Arabia and the revenues around Jericho. For that land produces the balsam, the most valuable of all things that grow there and found nowhere else, and also great quantities of fine date palm. While she was in these parts, and her familiarity with Herod grew, she tried to draw the king into intimacy with her, whether by nature simply indulging without concealment the pleasures that came her way, or perhaps feeling some real passion for him, or, what is more likely, laying the groundwork for a plot, preparing in advance the outrage that would then be done to him. In any case, her whole conduct showed her mastered by desire. Herod, who had never been well disposed toward Cleopatra, knowing her to be harsh toward everyone, and who now thought it right even to hate her, if out of sheer wantonness she had gone so far, and to strike first in punishing her, should she in fact set such a trap for him, brushed aside her advances, and took counsel with his friends, having her in his power to kill her. For he would rid everyone of many evils, all those to whom she had already been harsh, and to whom she still threatened to be so, and the same act, he thought, would serve Antony's interest too, since she would prove no more faithful to him either, should any occasion or need arise in which he required such loyalty. His friends, however, dissuaded him from this plan, first pointing out that it was not right, when he already faced graver dangers, to take on the most conspicuous risk of all, and pressing him earnestly to do nothing out of rashness. For Antony, they said, would never put up with it, not even if someone set his true interest plainly before his eyes, since the very belief that she had been taken from him by force and by plot would only inflame his passion the more, and no defense would appear moderate enough, given that the attempt had been made against a woman who held, in that age, the very highest rank, while any benefit claimed from it would only seem, alongside such presumption, a condemnation of Antony's own disposition toward her. From all this, it was clear that great and unending troubles would engulf his kingdom and his house, when he could instead, by turning aside the wrongdoing into which she was urging him, and to bring the crisis to a decent conclusion. By frightening him in this way, and pointing out plausibly how dangerous the venture was, they held him back from the attempt. He, however, courted Cleopatra with gifts and escorted her on her way to Egypt. Antony, having taken Armenia, sent Artabazes, son of Tigranes, to Egypt in chains along with his sons, the satraps, presenting them to Cleopatra together with the whole splendor of the kingdom he had taken from him. Artaxias, the eldest of his sons, escaped at that time and became king of Armenia. Later, Archelaus and Nero Caesar drove him out and restored his younger brother Tigranes to the throne, but that belongs to a later time. As for the tribute owed on the territory Antony had granted him, Herod, thinking it unsafe to give Cleopatra any pretext for hostility, was scrupulous in paying it. The Arab, however, though he had undertaken to Herod to pay the tribute, supplied the 200 talents for a time, but afterward grew malicious and slow in his payments. And even when he settled some part of it, he seemed to do so grudgingly. When he went on behaving this way, and in the end was unwilling to do anything just at all, Herod was minded to move against him, but waited for his opportunity until the Roman War. For with the Battle of Actium expected, which took place in the 187th Olympiad, Caesar was about to contend with Antony for the whole of the empire, while Herod, since his land had long enjoyed good pasture, and he had built up revenues and forces, mustered an allied force for Antony, attending most carefully to the preparations. Antony, however, said he had no need at all of his alliance, and instead ordered him to move against the Arab, for he had heard of the man's treachery both from Herod and from Cleopatra herself, who judged it to her advantage that each of them should suffer harm from the other. When this message came to him from Antony, Herod turned back and mustered his soldiery as though about to invade Arabia at once, and once cavalry and infantry forces had been prepared, he arrived at Diospolis, where the Arabs met him, for the preparations for war had not escaped their notice. A fierce battle took place, and the Jews prevailed. After this, a large Arab army gathered at Canatha, places belonging to Seal Syria. Herod, having learned of this in advance, came bringing against them the greater part of the force he had, and drawing near, he resolved to encamp in a good position, throw up a rampart, and attack from an advantageous position at the right moment. While he was arranging this, the mass of the Jews shouted for him to set aside delay and lead them against the Arabs. They were eager, trusting in their good order and buoyed by the spirit of those who had already won the first battle without even letting the enemy come to close quarters. Since they were in an uproar and showing every kind of eagerness, the king decided to make use of the crowd's enthusiasm, and after declaring beforehand that he would not fall short of their courage, he led the way himself under arms at the front of them all, with everyone following in their proper units. Terror fell at once upon the Arabs, They held their ground briefly, but when they saw how irresistible and full of spirit the Jews were, most of them broke and fled, and they would have been destroyed had not Athenion done harm to Herod and the Jews. This man, a general of Cleopatra's stationed in the region and hostile to Herod, had watched events with careful preparation. If the Arabs achieved some brilliant success, he had resolved to remain quiet, but if they were defeated, which is in fact what happened, he had made ready, with the men of the district who had gathered to him, to fall upon the Jews. And so, at that moment, falling unexpectedly upon them when they were exhausted and thought they had won, he caused great slaughter. For the Jews, having spent their eagerness on their acknowledged enemies and now acting carelessly in the confidence of victory, were quickly overcome by these new attackers and suffered many blows in terrain impassable to horses and full of rocks, ground of which those making the attack had far greater experience. While the Jews were faring badly, the Arabs took heart again, and turning back began killing those who were now in flight. Losses of every kind occurred among the slain, and not many of those who broke away made it safely back to the camp together. King Herod, having given up on the battle, rode off to bring help, but for all his haste, he did not arrive in time. The Jewish camp was captured, and the Arabs, for their part, had by no means enjoyed unmixed good fortune, having recovered against all expectation a victory that had very nearly slipped from them, and having stripped much strength from their opponents. From that point on, Herod turned to raiding, and by frequent incursions did great damage to Arab territory while encamping on the border. Though in the open he generally avoided coming to close quarters, he made himself far from harmless through the relentlessness and diligence with which he attended in every way to his own men, repairing the setback. Meanwhile, as the Battle of Actium was being joined between Caesar and Antony, in the 7th year of Herod's reign, the land of the Jews was shaken by an earthquake as had never happened before, causing great destruction among the livestock of the country. About 30,000 people also perished, crushed beneath collapsed houses. The army, however, since it was quartered in the open, suffered no harm at all from the disaster. When the Arabs learned of this, and it was reported to them far worse than the truth by those eager to gratify the hatred of their listeners, they grew still more confident, believing that the country had been overturned to their enemies' ruin and the people destroyed, so that nothing remained standing against them any longer. They seized the Jewish envoys, who had come to them concerning what had happened, and killed them, and advanced with the utmost eagerness against the Jewish forces. These did not wait for the attack, but, disheartened by their misfortunes and fallen into the deepest despair, abandoned the field. They had no hope of holding their own after being beaten in battle, nor of receiving help, given how badly things stood for them at home. Matters standing thus, the king came forward, persuading the officers with argument and trying to restore their fallen spirits. Having first stirred and encouraged some of the better men, he now ventured, something he had earlier hesitated to do, fearing they might prove difficult under their misfortunes, to address the mass of the people as well. He made the following appeal to the crowd. "I am not unaware, men, that many things have happened in this crisis to work against our undertakings, and it is natural that in such circumstances even those most distinguished for courage should not feel confident. But since the necessity of war presses upon us, and there is nothing among the things that have happened that a single deed well done cannot set right, I have chosen to encourage you, and at the same time, to show you the means by which you might hold fast to your own resolve. I wish first to demonstrate, concerning the war, that we wage it justly, driven to it by the insolence of our enemies. For if you learn this, it will be the greatest cause of eagerness in you, and after that to show that there is nothing formidable in our own position, and that we have every hope of victory. I will begin with the first point, calling you yourselves as witnesses of what I say. You know, surely, the lawlessness of the Arabs, men who deal so faithlessly even with everyone else, as one would expect of people who are barbarous and give no thought to God, but who have offended against us most of all, through greed and envy, lying in wait for our troubles at every opportunity. Why should I mention their many other offenses? When they themselves stood in danger of losing their own rule and becoming slaves to Cleopatra, who but we delivered them from that fear? For my friendship with Antony, and his disposition toward us, were the reason these men suffered nothing irreparable, since the man took care to do nothing that might arouse our suspicion. Yet when he was nevertheless willing to grant Cleopatra certain portions from each of our kingdoms, I myself arranged even this, and by giving many gifts privately I secured safety for us both, taking the expense upon myself, paying 200 talents outright and standing surety for 200 more. These sums went to swell her revenue, but we ourselves were robbed of them by these very men. And yet it would have been fitting for the Jews to pay tribute or a share of their land to no one at all. But if that could not be, certainly not on behalf of those whom we ourselves had saved, nor should the Arabs, who admitted they owed us this much consideration and gratitude, have thought it right to wrong us by defrauding us, and that though we were not their enemies but their friends. Good faith, which is kept even toward the bitterest enemies, ought all the more to be preserved toward friends, but not among these men, who have taken it for the finest thing to profit by any means whatsoever, and hold that injustice brings no penalty, so long as profit can be had. There remains, then, a question for you, whether the unjust ought to be punished, a thing God himself wishes and always commands, that insolence and injustice be hated, and this when we go out to a war that is not only just but necessary. For what is agreed to be most lawless among both Greeks and barbarians, they have done to our envoys, slaughtering them. Though the Greeks say their heralds are sacred and inviolable, and we have learned the finest of our teachings and the holiest of our laws through messengers sent by God. For it is this very name that brings God into the sight of men and has power to reconcile enemies to enemies. What greater impiety, then, could there be than to kill envoys who speak on behalf of justice? How could such men, after doing such things, ever again enjoy stability in their lives or success in war? To me they seem altogether unable to. Perhaps, then, holiness and justice are on our side, but they may claim greater courage or greater numbers. But it is unworthy of you even to say this, for where justice is, God is with it, and where God is present, both numbers and courage are present as well. But let us also examine our own record. We won the first battle. When they engaged us a second time, they could not even withstand us, but fled at once, unable to bear our onset and our spirit. And when we were winning, Athenian attacked us, waging an unheralded war. Is this courage on their part, or a second act of lawlessness and ambush? Why then should we think any less of ourselves, when we ought rather to have greater hopes? How could we be terrified of men who, whenever they fight honestly, are always beaten, and who, whenever they are thought to prevail, do so only through injustice? And even if one supposes them noble, should this not spur us on all the more? For true courage lies not in attacking the weaker, but in being able to overcome even the stronger. And if anyone is dismayed by our own misfortunes, and by what happened in the earthquake, let him first consider that this very thing has deceived the Arabs too, who have taken what happened to be greater than it really was. And next, that it would not be fitting for the same event to produce boldness in them and cowardice in us. For their courage springs not from any strength of their own, but from the hope that we are already crippled by our misfortunes, whereas we, by advancing against them, will strip them of their overconfidence and recover for ourselves the courage to fight without further fear. For in truth, we have not been so badly damaged, nor, as some suppose, does what has happened show the wrath of God. These things are accidents and sufferings that occur in the course of nature. And if it had been done by God's design, it is clear that it has also ceased by his design, since he is satisfied with what has occurred. For had he wished to wrong us further, he would not have relented. And that he wishes this war to go forward, and knows it to be just, he has made plain himself. Though some perished in the earthquake out in the country, not one of those under arms suffered anything at all, but all of you were preserved, God making it clear that even if you had gone to war with your whole people, together with children and wives, you would have come through without irreparable harm. Bearing this in mind, and above all that you have God as your protector at every moment, go out against the unjust with righteous courage, men who broke faith with friendship, who show no truce in battle, who are impious toward envoys, and who are always overcome by your valor. Hearing this, the Jews became far more confident in spirit for the battle. Herod, after offering sacrifices according to custom, quickly gathered his men and led them against the Arabs, crossing the Jordan and encamping near the enemy. He decided to seize a fortress that lay between the two camps, reckoning that in this way he would both gain an advantage in bringing the battle to a swifter conclusion, and should delay prove necessary, would have secured for himself a well-fortified camp. Since the Arabs had the same idea, a contest arose over the position, first with skirmishing at a distance, then with more men coming to close quarters on both sides, until the Arabs were defeated and withdrew. This at once gave no small encouragement to the Jews. And considering the enemy's disposition, men who wished to do anything rather than come to battle, he ventured all the more boldly to tear apart their rampart and press up against their camp. Forced back by this, they came out in disorder, having lost all eagerness and hope of victory. Nevertheless, they came to close quarters, being more numerous and, under the pressure of necessity, driven to boldness, and a fierce battle took place, with no small numbers falling on both sides, until at last the Arabs turned and fled. There was great slaughter among those in flight, so that they died not only at the hands of the enemy, but also became the cause of their own destruction, trampled by their own numbers and disorderly rush and falling upon their own weapons. At any rate, 5,000 of them lay dead. The rest of their number managed to escape into their fortified camp, but had no secure hope of safety, for lack of provisions and especially of water. The Jews, pursuing them, were not strong enough to break in with them, but surrounded the rampart, and keeping watch, barred both those who wished to bring relief from entering and those who wished to flee from leaving. Being in such straits, then, So the Arabs sent envoys to Herod, at first to negotiate terms, and then, since thirst was pressing them hard, to accept any condition whatever and to beg only for their present safety. But Herod would not receive envoys, ransom for the captives, or any other reasonable offer. So bent was he on avenging the crimes they had committed against his people. Driven by necessity, and above all by thirst, they came forward and surrendered themselves to be led away and bound, and in 5 days 4,000 of them were captured in this way. On the sixth day, all who remained resolved to sally out, and in the manner of war, engage the enemy, choosing, if they must suffer, to die fighting rather than perish ingloriously a few at a time. Having decided this, they came out of their camp but held out no time at all in the battle, for their souls and bodies were already broken by ill use and had no strength left, though they made a brilliant show of fighting, counting it a gain, in their wretched state, even to die. About 7,000 of them fell in that first engagement. Struck by such a blow, they lost what spirit had remained to them, and amazed at Herod's generalship in the very disasters he had inflicted, they yielded from then on and proclaimed him champion of their nation. Herod, having formed too high an opinion of himself from these successes, returned home, having gained honor as well through this display of courage. Everything else, then, had gone well for him, since he had proved himself formidable in every undertaking. But danger now fell upon him as the decision over the whole world was reached, with Antony defeated by Caesar in the battle at Actium. At that time, both Herod himself and those around him, enemies and friends alike, gave up his cause for lost, for it was not to be expected that he would escape unpunished after so great a friendship with Antony. His friends therefore despaired of any hope for him, while those who were hostile to him pretended openly to share in his distress, but privately nursed a hidden pleasure, expecting to profit from the change of fortune. Herod himself, seeing that Hyrcanus was the only man of royal rank left, thought it in his interest no longer to leave him in his way. If he himself should come through safely and escape the danger, he judged it safer that no man more worthy of the throne be waiting in ambush for such a crisis as his. But if he should suffer some harm at Caesar's hands, he was eager, out of jealousy, to remove the one man who would then be left to obtain the kingdom. While Herod was turning this over in his mind, an opening was given him by the others as well. Hyrcanus, being a man of mild character, did not think it right, either then or at any other time, to meddle in affairs or to grasp at anything new, but yielded to fortune and was content to accept whatever it brought about. But Alexandra was contentious, and, carried away without restraint by the hope of a change of fortune, she kept urging her father not to wait indefinitely for Herod's lawlessness to fall upon their house, but to forestall it by securing their future hopes in advance. She pressed him to write on the matter to Malchus, who held the office of Arabarch, asking him to receive Hyrcanus and keep him in safety, Since if they withdrew and matters concerning Herod turned out as was likely, given his enmity with Caesar, they alone would be left to recover the throne, both because of their lineage and because of the goodwill of the people. Although she urged this, Hyacinus rejected her words at first, but since she was possessed by a kind of stubborn, womanish passion and would not let the matter rest by night or day, but was forever speaking of these things and of Herod's plot against them, he was at last persuaded to give a letter to a certain Dositheus, one of his friends, in which he had arranged for the Arab to send horsemen to receive him and escort him to the Sea of Asphaltitis, which lies 300 stads from the borders of Jerusalem. He trusted Dositheus, because the man was in attendance on him and on Alexandra, and had no small grievance against Herod. He was a kinsman of Joseph, whom Herod had put to death, and a brother of those killed at Tyre earlier by Antony. Yet none of this induced Dositheus to remain faithful to Hyacinus in this service. Instead, preferring the hopes to be had from the reigning king over those of Hyacinus, he handed the letter over to Herod. Herod, welcoming this show of loyalty, urged him to render one further service: to fold the letter, seal it, and deliver it to Malchus, and then to bring back whatever reply he received, since it mattered a great deal to know Malchus's own intentions. Dositheus carried this out eagerly, and the Arab wrote back that he would receive Hyacinus and all who were with him, and all the Jews who shared his views, and that he would send a force to bring them safely to him, and that Hyacinus would lack nothing he might require. When Herod received this letter too, he at once summoned Hyacinus and questioned him about the agreement he had made with Malchus. Hyacinus denied it, but Herod showed the letters to the council and had the man put to death. This is the account we give, as it is preserved in the memoirs of King Herod. But other writers do not agree with it in these particulars. They hold that Herod did not put Hyacinus to death on such grounds, but rather brought the charge against him out of a plot devised in his own manner. For they write it this way, that at a certain banquet, giving no hint of suspicion, Herod put a question to Hyacinus, asking whether he had received any letters from Malchus. And Hyacinus admitted that he had received letters of greeting, and when asked further whether he had also received any gift, he replied that he had received nothing more than 4 riding animals sent to him. Herod, they say, twisted this into a charge of bribery and treason and ordered the man strangled. As evidence that he met such an end though guilty of nothing, they cite the mildness of his character, and the fact that he had shown no sign of rashness or impetuosity, either in his youth or when he himself held the kingship, but even then had handed over most of the administration of affairs to Antipater. At that time, moreover, he was more than 80 years old, and he knew that Herod's power was now secure in every way. He had even crossed the Euphrates, leaving behind those on the far side who honored him, as though he meant to belong wholly to Herod from then on. It was, they argue, altogether implausible that a man of his nature would undertake anything or lay hold of any innovation, and that this charge was merely a pretext contrived by Herod. Such, then, was the end that befell Hyacinus, a man who experienced many and varied turns of fortune in the course of his life. At the very outset, while his mother Alexandra was queen, he was made high priest of the Jewish nation and held that honor for 9 years. When he succeeded to the throne after his mother's death, he held it for only 3 months before he was driven out by his brother Aristobulus, and was afterward restored by Pompey, recovering all his honors, in which he continued for 40 years. Deprived of them a second time by Antigonus and mutilated in body, he was taken captive by the Parthians. From there, he returned home in due course, drawn by the hopes held out to him by Herod, none of which came to pass as he expected, so full of suffering was his life. And most grievous of all, as we have already said, in his old age he met an end he did not deserve. For he seems in every way to have been a fair and moderate man, content to let most of the government be conducted by his ministers, being neither meddlesome nor skilled in the direction of a kingdom. And it was through his mildness that Antipater and Herod were able to advance to the position they reached. Yet in the end, they found from him no reward either just or pious for such an end as this. When Herod had thus removed Hyacinus from his path, he hastened to meet Caesar, unable to hope for anything good regarding his own position from the friendship he had had with Antony. He held Alexandra under suspicion, fearing that she might seize the opportunity to stir up the people to revolt and throw the affairs of the kingdom into turmoil. He therefore entrusted everything to his brother Pheroras, and settled his mother Cypros and his sister and his whole family at Masada, instructing them, if they should hear anything untoward concerning him, to hold fast to their position. As for his wife Mariam, since it was not possible, given the ill feeling between her and his sister and mother, for her to share the same household with them, he settled her at Alexandrian together with her mother Alexandra, leaving Joseph the treasurer and Soemus the Icharian in charge of them there. These men had from the start been most loyal to him, and were now left, ostensibly to guard the women out of honor to them. But they had also received a secret order, if they should learn anything untoward concerning him, to make away with both women at once, and to preserve the kingdom, so far as lay in their power, for his children together with his brother Pheroras. Having given these instructions, he himself hastened to Rhodes to meet Caesar. When he had sailed into the city, though he had laid aside his diadem, he yielded nothing of the rest of his dignity, and when he was granted an audience in the course of their meeting, he displayed all the more clearly the greatness of his spirit. He turned neither to entreaty, as might have been expected of one in such a position, nor did he offer any plea as a man who had done wrong, but gave an account of his actions without any attempt to minimize them. He told Caesar that he had indeed enjoyed the greatest friendship with Antony, and had done everything within his power to see the outcome fall in Antony's favor, though he had not personally taken part in the campaign against the Arabs, but had instead sent him money and grain. Even this, he said, was less than what was owed by him, for a man who acknowledged himself a friend and who knew Antony to be his benefactor ought to have risked his whole self, in soul and body and possessions, on his behalf, in ways he himself had fallen short of doing as he should have. Yet, he said, he could take this much comfort in his own conduct, that he had not abandoned Antony after his defeat at Actium, nor gone over with his hopes to the winning side once fortune had plainly begun to shift. Instead, he had kept himself, if not a worthy ally in arms, at least the most loyal counselor he could be to Antony, pointing out to him the one course by which he might still be saved and not fall from power altogether, to put Cleopatra to death. For with her removed, it would have been open to him both to rule his own affairs and more easily to reach an accommodation with Caesar in place of hostility. But Antony, giving no thought to any of this, chose folly, to his own ruin but to Caesar's advantage. "Now, therefore," he said, "if you judge my zeal by your anger at Antony, I will not deny what I have done, nor will I refuse to declare my goodwill toward him openly. But if you set the person aside and ask instead who I am toward my benefactors, and what sort of friend I prove to be, you will be able to know us by the experience of what has already occurred. For though the name may change, the constancy of the friendship itself will be no less able to prove its worth in us." By speaking in this way, and showing throughout the free and noble bearing of his spirit, he won no small hold over Caesar, who was himself a man of high ambition and magnanimity, so that the very charges brought against him now became grounds for building goodwill toward him. Caesar restored the diadem to him, and, encouraging him to show himself no less devoted than he had formerly been toward Antony, held him thereafter in every honor, adding that Quintus Didius had written to him that Herod had given his full support, with every eagerness, in the affair of the gladiators. Held in such high regard, and seeing his kingdom, beyond all expectation, established once more on firmer ground than before, by the gift of Caesar and the decree of the Roman people, which Caesar had arranged for him to secure that stability, he escorted Caesar as far as Egypt, bestowing gifts beyond his means both on Caesar himself and on his friends, and displaying every kind of magnanimity. He also asked, on behalf of one of Antony's intimate friends, that Alexander be spared any irreversible harm, but did not obtain this, since Caesar was already bound by an oath. He then returned to Judea with greater honor and confidence than before, and gave those who had expected the opposite outcome cause for astonishment, since he always seemed, by the favor of God, to come away from danger with even greater brilliance. Soon after this, he was occupied with receiving Caesar, who was about to cross from Syria into Egypt. When Caesar arrived, Herod received him at Ptolemais with every mark of royal attendance, and furnished the army too with entertainment and abundance of provisions. He was ranked among Caesar's most devoted supporters, riding alongside him as he drew up his forces, and entertaining him and his friends, 150 in number, all served in a manner of great expense and luxury. He also supplied, to those crossing the waterless region, whatever provisions were urgently needed, so that neither wine nor water, the latter being in even greater demand among the soldiers, ran short. Caesar himself he presented with 800 talents, and gave everyone occasion to reflect that the resources he displayed in these services were far greater and more splendid than the kingdom he actually possessed. This did all the more to establish confidence in his goodwill and zeal, and he gained the greatest benefit from the needs of the moment by matching them with his own magnanimity. And when the leading men were returning again from Egypt, he showed himself inferior to none of them in the services he rendered. At that time, however, once he was back in his kingdom, he found his household in turmoil, and his wife Mariam and her mother Alexandra in a state of deep resentment. They believed, and their suspicion was not unfounded, that they had been placed in that stronghold not for the safety of their persons, but under guard, so that they might have no power over anything, not even over themselves, and they bore this bitterly. Mariam, for her part, took the king's love for her to be nothing but pretense and a deception practiced for his own advantage, and she was distressed that, even if some harm should befall him, he had left her no hope of surviving on his account, recalling the orders that had been given to Joseph. So already she was working through flattery on the guards, and especially on Soemus, since she perceived that everything lay in his hands. Soemus, at first, was faithful, holding back nothing of what Herod had entrusted to him. But, worn down little by little through the words and gifts with which the women lavishly courted him more assiduously than he could resist, he at last disclosed every one of the king's instructions, above all because he did not expect Herod to return to the same position of power again. And in doing so, he supposed he would gain no small favor with the women, who were likely, either as queens or as close kin to the king, not to fail of the standing they still held, but to have all the more reason to reward him if they should come to reign or come near to the one who reigned. He was also encouraged in this hope, and would be no less unwilling, even if Herod returned having managed everything to his own satisfaction, to refuse his wife anything she wanted, for he knew that the king's love for Mariam went beyond words. Mariam was distressed to hear that these instructions had leaked out, seeing that there would be no end to the dangers she faced from Herod, and she was greatly troubled, praying not that she would meet with the same fate as the others, but judging that a life spent with him, if it came to that, would be unbearable. She showed this later without concealing anything of what she felt. For when Herod, having succeeded in the great matters he had, beyond hope, brought off, sailed back, and, as was natural, first brought the good news to his wife, singling her out above everyone else because of his love and their long intimacy, and greeted her warmly, she neither rejoiced at his account of his good fortune nor could conceal her feelings. Instead, out of a sense of her own degradation and abiding nobility, she groaned at his embraces and made it plain that his stories vexed her more than they pleased her, so that it became not merely suspicious but obvious, and it disturbed Herod. He was distressed to see his wife's inexplicable hatred of him showing so openly, and he was troubled by the whole affair. Unable to bear his love for her, he could not settle either into anger or reconciliation, but kept passing from one to the other, and found himself in great perplexity over both. Caught in this way between hatred and affection, and often ready to punish her arrogance, because his soul had already been captured, he grew too weak to remove the woman. In sum, he would gladly have punished her, yet he feared that in doing so he would unwittingly exact from himself, by her death, a greater penalty than hers. His sister and his mother, seeing him disposed in this way toward Mariam, thought this the best opportunity to bring their hatred of her to bear, and talked a great deal, provoking Herod with slanders capable of stirring up both hatred and jealousy at once. He did not receive such talk unwillingly, yet he did not feel confident enough, believing what he heard, to act against his wife. Still, he grew ever worse disposed toward her, and their mutual passion kept rekindling itself, she not concealing her feelings, and he always turning his love into anger. And some fatal act would have been done at once, had not news then arrived that Caesar was victorious in the war, and that, with Antony and Cleopatra dead, he now held Egypt. Hastening to meet Caesar, Herod left matters at home as they stood. As he was leaving, Mariam came to see Soemus off, acknowledged with much gratitude the care he had shown, and asked the king to grant him a district to govern. And he obtained this honor. Herod, once in Egypt, met with Caesar with greater freedom of speech, now as a friend, and was honored most highly. For Caesar gave him the 400 Galatians who had served as Cleopatra's bodyguard, and restored to him the territory that had been taken from him because of her. He also added to his kingdom Gadara, Hippos, and Samaria, and on the coast, Gaza, Anthedon, Jaffa, and Strato's Tower. Having achieved even this, he grew still more distinguished. He escorted Caesar as far as Antioch and then returned, and to the same degree that his outward circumstances seemed to him to be conducing to his happiness, to that same degree he suffered within his own household, and above all in his marriage, where he had earlier seemed most fortunate of all. For he had conceived a passion for Mariam as great as any recorded in history, together with a just regard for her. She, in most respects, was chaste and faithful to him, but she had by nature a certain harshness mixed with her womanly qualities.